My work principles are basically the life principles applied to groups. I will show you, principle by principle, how an actual, practical, believability-weighted decision-making system converts independent thinking into effective group decision-making. I believe that such a system can work to make any kind of organization, business, government, philanthropic, both more effective and more satisfying to belong to. Part 3. Work Principles. For any group or organization to function well, its work principles must be aligned with its members' life principles. I don't mean that they have to be aligned on everything, but I do mean that they have to be aligned on the most important things, like the mission they're on and how they will be with each other. If people in an organization feel that alignment, they will treasure their relationships and work together harmoniously. Its culture will permeate everything they do. If they don't, they will work for different, often conflicting goals, and will be confused about how they should be with each other. For that reason, it pays for all organizations, companies, governments, foundations, schools, hospitals, and so on, to spell out their principles and values clearly and explicitly, and to operate by them consistently. Those principles and values aren't vague slogans like, the customer always comes first, or we should strive to be the best in our industry, but a set of concrete directives that anyone can understand, get aligned on, and carry out. As we shift our attention from life principles to work principles, I will explain how we went about achieving these alignments at Bridgewater and how that affected our results. But first, I want to explain how I think about organizations. An organization is a machine consisting of two major parts, culture and people. Each influences the other because the people who make up an organization determine the kind of culture it has, and the culture of the organization determines the kinds of people who fit in. A great organization has both great people and great culture. Companies that get progressively better over time have both. Nothing is more important or more difficult than to get the culture and people right. B. Great people have both great character and great capabilities. By great character, I mean that they are radically truthful, radically transparent, and deeply committed to the mission of the organization. By great capabilities, I mean they have the abilities and skills to do their jobs excellently. People who have one without the other are dangerous and should be removed from the organization. People who have both are rare and should be treasured. C. Great cultures bring problems and disagreements to the surface and solve them well. And they love imagining and building great things that haven't been built before. Doing that sustains their evolution. In our case, we do that by having an idea meritocracy that strives for meaningful work and meaningful relationships through radical truth and radical transparency. By meaningful work, I mean work that people are excited to get their heads into, and by meaningful relationships, I mean those in which there is a genuine caring for each other, like an extended family. I find these reinforce each other, and that being radically truthful and radically transparent with each other makes both the work and the relationships better. By constantly looking down on the machine, its managers can objectively compare the outcomes it produces with their goals. If the outcomes are consistent with those goals, then the machine is working effectively. If the outcomes are inconsistent with the goals, then something is wrong with either the design of the machine or the people who are part of it, and the problem needs to be diagnosed so the machine can be modified. As laid out in Chapter 2 of Life Principles, this ideally happens in a 5-step process. First, having clear goals. Second, identifying the problems that are preventing the goals from being achieved. Third, diagnosing what parts of the machine, in other words, which people or which designs are not working well. Fourth, designing the changes that'll bring about the improvements. And fifth, doing what is needed. This is the fastest and most efficient way that an organization improves. I call this process of converting problems into progress looping, and here's how it happens through time. Picture a loop. First, the problem takes you off track from your goals and makes things worse than you planned. That is the downward curve in the loop. If you identify the decline, diagnose the problems that caused it so that you get at their root causes, come up with new designs, and then push them through, the trajectory will loop back on itself and continue an upward ascent. That's the upward curve in the loop that you want. If you fail to identify the problem, or don't come up with a good design, or fail to push the new design through effectively, the decline will continue and never loop back up. A manager's ability to recognize when outcomes are inconsistent with goals and then modify designs and assemble people to rectify them makes all the difference in the world. The more often and more effectively a manager does this, the steeper the upward trajectory. As I explained in Life Principles, this is what I believe evolution looks like for all organisms and organizations. Having a culture and people that will evolve in this way is critical because the world changes quickly and in ways that can't possibly be anticipated. I'm sure you can think of a number of companies that failed to identify and address their problems on time and ended up in a terminal decline, such as BlackBerry and Palm, and a rare few that have consistently looped up well. Most don't. For example, only 6 of the companies that 40 years ago made up the Dow Jones 30, which is about when Bridgewater got started, are still in the Dow Jones average today. Many of them, American Can, American Tobacco, Bethlehem Steel, General Foods, Inco, Woolworth, don't even exist. Some, such as Sears Roebuck, Johns Manville, Eastman Kodak, are so different as to be almost unrecognizable. And many of the standouts on the list today, Apple, Cisco, and so on, were yet to be founded. The rare few that have been able to evolve well over the decades have been successful at that evolutionary looping process, which is also the process that has made Bridgewater progressively more successful for over 40 years. That is the process I want to pass along to you. I want to reemphasize that nothing is more important or more difficult than to get the culture and the people right. Whatever successes we've had at Bridgewater were the result of doing that, and whatever failures were due to our not doing it adequately. That might seem odd because as a global macroeconomic investor, one might think that, above all else, I had to get the economics and investments right, which is true. But to do that, I needed to get the right people and culture right first. And to inspire me to do what I did, I needed to have meaningful work and meaningful relationships. As the entrepreneur builder of Bridgewater, I naturally shaped the organization to be consistent with my values and principles. I went after what I wanted most in that way that seemed most natural to me with people I chose to be with, and we in Bridgewater evolved together. If you had asked me what my objective was when I started out, I would have said to have fun working with the people I like. Work was a game I played with passion, and I wanted to have a blast playing it with people I enjoyed and respected. I started Bridgewater out of my apartment with a pal I played rugby with, who had no experience in the markets, and a friend we hired as our assistant. I certainly wasn't thinking about management at the time. Management seemed like something people in gray suits with slide presentations did. I never set out to manage, let alone have principles about work and management. From hearing these life principles, you know that I like to imagine and build out new, practical concepts that never existed before. I love doing these things with the people who were on the same mission with me. I treasured thoughtful disagreement with them as a way of learning and raising our odds of making good decisions, and I wanted all the people I worked with to be my partners rather than my employees. In a nutshell, I was looking for meaningful work and meaningful relationships. I quickly learned that the best way to do that was to have great partnerships with great people. To me, great partnerships come from sharing common values and interests, having similar approaches to pursuing them, and being reasonable and having consideration for each other. At the same time, partners must be willing to hold each other to high standards and work through their disagreements. The main test of a great partnership is not whether the partners ever disagree. People in all healthy relationships disagree. It's whether they can bring their disagreements to the surface and get through them well. Having clear processes for resolving disagreements efficiently and clearly is essential for business partnerships, marriages, and all forms of partnership. My wanting these things attracted others who wanted the same things, which drove how we shaped Bridgewater together. When there were five of us, it was totally different than when there were 50 of us, which was totally different than it was when there were 500 of us, 1,000, and so on. As we grew, most everything changed beyond recognition, except for our core values and principles. When Bridgewater was still a small company, the principles by which we operated were more implicit than explicit. But as more and more new people came in, I couldn't take for granted that they would understand and preserve them. I realized that I needed to write our principles out explicitly and explain the logic behind them. I remember the precise moment when this shift occurred. It was when the number of people at Bridgewater passed 67. Up until then, I had personally chosen each employee's holiday gift and written them a lengthy personalized card, but trying to do it that year broke my back. From that point on, an increasing number of people came in who didn't work closely with me, so I couldn't assume that they would understand where I was coming from or what I was striving to create, which was an idea meritocracy built on tough love. This brings me to a principle. Tough love is effective for achieving both great work and great relationships. To give you an idea what I mean by tough love, think of Vince Lombardi, who personified it for me. From when I was 10 years old until I was 18, Lombardi was head coach of the Green Bay Packers. With limited resources, he led his team to 5 NFL championships. He won 2 NFL Coach of the Year awards, and many still call him the best coach of all time. Lombardi loved his players, and he pushed them to be great. I admired, and still admired, how uncompromising his standards were. His players, their fans, and he himself all benefited from this approach. I wish Lombardi had written out his principles for me to read. A. In order to be great, one can't compromise the uncompromisable. Yet I see people doing it all the time, usually to avoid making others or themselves feel uncomfortable, which is not just backwards, but counterproductive. Putting comfort ahead of success produces worse results for everyone. I both loved the people I worked with and pushed them to be great, and I expected them to do the same with me. From the beginning, I felt that the people I worked with at Bridgewater were part of my extended family. When they or members of their family got sick, I put them in touch with my personal doctor to make sure that they were all well taken care of. I invited them all to stay at my house in Vermont on weekends and loved it when they took me up on it. I celebrated their marriages and the births of their children with them and mourned the losses of their loved ones. But to be clear, this was no love fest. We were tough on each other too, so we all could be as great as we could be. I learned that the more caring we gave each other, the tougher we could be on each other. And the tougher we were on each other, the better we performed and the more rewards there were for us to share. This cycle was self-reinforcing. I found that operating this way made the lows less low and the highs higher. It even made the bad times better than the good times in some ways. Think about some of your toughest experiences in life. I bet it's as true for you as it has been for me, that going through them with people you cared about, who cared about you, and were working as hard as you were for the same mission, was incredibly rewarding. As hard as they were, we look back on some of these challenging times as our finest moments. For most people, being part of a great community on a shared mission is even more rewarding than the money. Numerous studies have shown that there is little or no correlation between one's happiness and the amount of money one accumulates, yet there is a strong correlation between one's happiness and the quality of one's relationships. I laid this thinking out in a memo to Bridgewater in 1996. It said, Bridgewater is not about plodding along at some kind of moderate standard. It's about working like hell to achieve a standard that's extraordinarily high and then getting the satisfaction that comes along with that sort of super achievement. Our overriding objective is excellence, or more precisely, constant improvement, a superb, constantly improving company in all respects. Conflict in the pursuit of excellence is a terrific thing. There should be no hierarchy based on age or seniority. Power should lie in the reasoning, not the position of the individual. The best ideas win, no matter who they come from. Criticism is an essential ingredient in the improvement process, yet, if handled incorrectly, can be destructive. It should be handled objectively. There should be no hierarchy in the giving or receiving of criticism. Teamwork and spirit are essential, including intolerance of substandard performance. This is referring to two things. First, one's recognition of the responsibilities one has to help the team achieve its common goal. And second, the willingness to help others work within a group toward these common goals. Our fates are intertwined. One should know that others can be relied on to help. As a corollary, substandard performance cannot be tolerated anywhere because it would hurt everyone. The memo went on to say, long-term relationships are both intrinsically gratifying and efficient and should be intentionally built. Turnover requires retraining and therefore creates setbacks. Money is a byproduct of excellence, not a goal. Our overriding objective is excellence and constant improvement at Bridgewater. To be clear, it's not to make lots of money. The natural extension of this is not that you should be happy with little money. On the contrary, you should expect to make a lot. If we operate consistently with this philosophy, we should be productive and the company should do well financially. Each person at Bridgewater should act like an owner, responsible for operating in this way and holding others accountable to operate this way. The next principle is, a believability-weighted idea meritocracy is the best system for making effective decisions. Unlike Lombardi, whose success is dependent on having his players follow his instructions, I needed my players to be independent thinkers who could bang around their different points of view and reach better conclusions than any one of us could come up with on our own. I needed to create an environment in which everyone had the right and the responsibility to make sense of things for themselves and to fight openly for what they think is best, and where the best thinking won out. I needed a real idea meritocracy, not some theoretical version of it. That's because an idea meritocracy, in other words, a system that brings together smart, independent thinkers and has them productively disagree to come up with the best possible collective thinking and resolve their disagreements in a believability-weighted way, will outperform any other decision-making system. Our idea meritocratic system evolved over the decades. At first, we just argued like hell with each other about what was best, and by thrashing through our disagreements, came up with better paths than if we made our decisions individually. But as Bridgewater grew and our range of disagreements and needs to resolve them changed, we became more explicit in how this idea meritocracy would work. We needed a system that could both effectively weigh the believability of different people to come up with the best decisions, and do that in a way that was so obviously fair everyone would recognize it as such. I knew that without a system, we would lose both the best thinking and the best thinkers, and I'd be stuck with either kiss-asses or subversives who kept their disagreements and hidden resentments to themselves. For this to work, I believed, and still believe, that we need to be radically truthful and radically transparent with each other. Radical truth and radical transparency. By radical truth, I mean not filtering one's thoughts and one's questions, especially the critical ones. If we don't talk openly about our issues and have paths for working them through, we won't have partners who collectively own our outcomes. By radical transparency, I mean giving most everyone the ability to see most everything. To give people anything less than total transparency would make them vulnerable to others' spin and deny them the ability to figure things out for themselves. Radical transparency reduces harmful office politics and the risks of bad behavior because bad behavior is more likely to take place behind closed doors than out in the open. Some people have called this way of operating radical straightforwardness. I knew that if radical truth and radical transparency didn't apply across the board, we would develop two classes of people at the company, those with power who were in the know and those who aren't. So I pushed them both to their limits. To me, a pervasive idea meritocracy equals radical truth plus radical transparency plus believability-weighted decision-making. From a small group of people arguing internally about what's true and what to do about it, we've developed approaches, technologies, and tools over the last 40 years that have taken us to a whole other level, which has been eye-opening and invaluable in ways that you'll be able to hear about in the tools chapter at the end of this book. We've always been unwavering in providing this environment, and we let the people who didn't like it self-select themselves out of the company. By being radically truthful and radically transparent, we could see that we all have terribly incomplete or distorted perspectives. This isn't unique at Bridgewater. You would recognize the same thing if you could see in the heads of the people around you. As explained in the chapter, understand that people are wired very differently. People tend to see the same situations in dramatically different ways, depending on how our brains are wired. Seeing this will help you evolve. At first, most people remain stuck in their own heads, stubbornly clinging to the idea that their views are best and that something is wrong with other people who don't see things their way. But when they repeatedly face the questions, how do you know that you're not the wrong one? And what processes would you use to draw upon these different perspectives to make the best decisions? They are forced to confront their own believability and see things through others' eyes as well as their own. This shift in perspective is what produces great collective decision-making. Ideally, this takes place in an open-source way, with the best ideas freely flowing, living, dying, and producing rapid evolution based on their merits. Most people initially find this process very uncomfortable. While most people appreciate it intellectually, they typically are challenged by it emotionally because it requires them to separate themselves from their ego's attachment to being right and try to see what they have a hard time seeing. A small minority get it and love it from the start. A slightly larger minority can't stand it and leave the company. And the majority stick with it, get better at it with time, and eventually wouldn't want to operate any other way. While operating this way might sound difficult and inefficient, it's actually extremely efficient. In fact, it's much harder and much less efficient to work in an organization in which most people don't know what their colleagues are really thinking. Also, when people can't be totally open, they can't be themselves. As Harvard developmental psychologist Bob Keegan, who has studied Bridgewater, likes to say, in most companies, people are doing two jobs, their actual job and the job of managing others' impressions of how they're doing their job. For us, that's terrible. We found that bringing everything to the surface first removes the need to try to look good and second, eliminates time required to guess what people are thinking. In doing this, it creates more meaningful work and more meaningful relationships. Here are the forces behind Bridgewater's self-reinforcing evolutionary spiral. First, we went from an independent thinker who wanted to achieve audacious goals to a group of independent thinkers who wanted to achieve audacious goals. Next, to enable these independent thinkers to be effective in their decision-making, we created an idea meritocracy based on principles that ensured we would be radically honest and radically transparent with each other, have thoughtful disagreements, and have idea meritocratic ways of getting past our disagreements to make our decisions. Then we recorded these decision-making principles on paper and later encoded them into computers and made our decisions based on them. That produced our successes and failures, which produced more learnings, which were written into more principles that were systemized and acted upon. This process resulted in excellent work and excellent relationships that led to us having well-rewarded and happy employees and clients. That led us to be able to bring in more audacious independent thinkers with more audacious goals to strengthen this self-reinforcing upward spiral. We did this over and over again, which produced the evolutionary looping behind Bridgewater's 40-plus years of success. This really works. You don't have to take my word for it. There are two ways you can evaluate the likelihood that this approach and the principles that follow from it are as powerful as I believe they are. You can look at the results they produced and look at the logic behind them. As for the results, like Lombardi's and the Packers, our track record speaks for itself. We've consistently gotten better over 40-plus years, going from my two-bedroom apartment to become the fifth most important private company in the U.S. according to Fortune, and the world's largest hedge fund, making more total money for our clients than any other hedge fund in history. Bridgewater and I have received over 100 industry awards, including 3 Lifetime Achievement Awards, not to mention remarkable financial and psychological awards, and most importantly, amazing relationships. But even more important than these results is the underlying cause-effect logic behind these principles, which came before the results. Over 40 years ago, this way of operating was a controversial, untested theory that nevertheless seemed logical to me. I will explain this logic to you in the coming chapters. That way you can assess it for yourself. There's no doubt that our approach is very different. Some people have even described Bridgewater as a cult. The truth is that Bridgewater succeeds because it's the opposite of a cult. The essential difference between a culture of people with shared values, which is a great thing, and a cult, which is a terrible thing, is the extent to which there is independent thinking. Cults demand unquestioning obedience. Thinking for yourself and challenging each other's ideas is anti-cult behavior, and that's the essence of what we're doing at Bridgewater. Who's crazy? Some people would say that our approach is crazy, but think about it. Which approach do you think is crazy and which one is sensible? One where people are truthful and transparent, or one in which most people keep their real thoughts hidden? One where problems, mistakes, weaknesses, and disagreements are brought to the surface and thoughtfully discussed? Or one in which they are not forthrightly brought to the surface and discussed? One in which the right to criticize is non-hierarchical? Or one in which it primarily comes from the top down? One in which objective pictures of what people are like are derived through lots of data and broad triangulations of people? Or one in which evaluations of people are more arbitrary? One in which the organization pursues very high standards for achieving both meaningful work and meaningful relationships? Or one in which work quality and relationship quality are not equally valued, or the standards aren't as high? Which kind of organization do you think will enable better development for the people who work there, foster deeper relationships between them, and produce better results? Which approach would you prefer to see the leaders and organizations that you deal with follow? Which way of being would you prefer the people who run our government to follow? My bet is that after listening to this book, you will agree that our way of operating is far more sensible than conventional ways of operating. But remember that my most fundamental principle is that you have to think for yourself. So when reviewing these principles, assess them for yourself. Why I wrote this book and how you can get the most out of it. If you're inside Bridgewater, I'm passing these principles on in my own words so that you can see the dream and the approach through my eyes. Bridgewater will evolve from where it is now based on what you and others in the next generation of leadership want and how you go about getting it. This book is intended to help you. How you use it is up to you. Whether or not this culture continues is up to you and those who succeed me in the leadership role. It's my responsibility not to be attached to Bridgewater being the way I would want it to be. It is most important that you and others who succeed me make your own independent choices. Like a parent with adult children, I want you all to be strong, independent thinkers who will do well without me. I've done my best to bring you to this point. Now is the time for you to step up and for me to fade away. If you're outside Bridgewater and thinking about how these principles might apply to your organization, this book is meant to prompt your thinking, not to give you an exact formula to follow. You don't have to adopt all or any of these principles, though I do recommend you consider them all. Many people who run other organizations have adopted some of these principles, modified others, and rejected many. Whatever you want to do with them is fine with me. These principles provide a framework you can modify to suit your own needs. Maybe you will pursue the same goal and maybe you won't. Chances are that, in any case, you will collect some valuable stuff. If you share my goal of having your organization be a real idea meritocracy, I believe this book will be invaluable to you because I'm told that no other organization has thought through or pushed the concepts of how to be a real idea meritocracy as far as Bridgewater has. If doing that is important to you and you pursue it with unwavering determination, you will encounter your own barriers, you will find your own ways around them, and you will get better, even if imperfectly. While these principles are good general rules, it's important to remember that every rule has exceptions, and no set of rules can ever substitute for common sense. Think of these rules as being like a GPS. A GPS helps you get where you're going, but if you follow it blindly off a bridge, well, that would be your fault, not the GPS's. And just as a GPS that gives bad directions can be fixed by updating its software, it's important to raise and discuss exceptions to the principles as they occur so that they can evolve and improve over time. No matter what path you choose to follow, your organization is a machine made up of culture and people that will interact to produce outcomes, and those outcomes will provide feedback about how well your organization is working. Learning from this feedback should lead you to modify the culture and the people so your organizational machine improves. This dynamic is so important that I've organized work principles around it in three sections. To get the culture right, to get the people right, and to build and evolve your machine. Each chapter within these sections begins with a higher level principle. Listening to them will give you a good sense of the main concepts in each chapter. Under these higher level principles, there are a number of supporting principles built around the many different types of decisions that need to be made. To help people find the appropriate principles, we created a tool called the Coach that allows people to type in their particular issue and find the principles to help them with it. I will soon be making that available to the public, along with many of the other management tools you'll hear about in the final section of the book. My main objective is not to sell you on these principles, but to share the most valuable lessons I've learned over my more than 40-year journey. My goal is to get you to think hard about the trade-offs you'll face in many types of situations. By thinking about the trade-offs behind the principles, you'll be able to decide for yourself which principles are best for you. This brings me to my most fundamental work principle. Make your passion and your work one and the same, and do it with people you want to be with. Work is either a job you do to earn the money to pay for the life you want, or what you do to achieve your mission, or some mix of the two. I urge you to make it as much to achieve a mission as possible, recognizing, of course, the value of earning the money to pay for the life that you want to have. If you do that, most everything will go better than if you don't do that. I wrote Work Principles primarily for those of you who want to follow your passion and achieve your mission. Back over to you, Jeremy.
To get the culture right, you have to work in a culture that suits you. That's fundamental to your happiness and your effectiveness. You also must work in a culture that is effective in producing great outcomes, because if you don't, you won't get the psychic and material rewards that keep you motivated. In this section on culture, I will share my thoughts on how to match your culture to your needs, and I'll explain the type of culture that I wanted and that has worked so well for me, an idea meritocracy. In Chapter 1, I explain what an idea meritocracy looks like and explore why radical truth and radical transparency are essential for it to work well. Being radically truthful and radically transparent are probably the most difficult principles to internalize, because they are so different from what most people are used to. Because this way of being is frequently misunderstood, I tried especially hard to be crystal clear in conveying why we operate this way and how it works in practice. In Chapter 2, we will turn our attention to why and how to build a culture that fosters meaningful relationships. Besides being rewarding themselves, meaningful relationships enable the radical truth and transparency that allow us to hold each other accountable for producing excellence. I believe that great cultures, like great people, recognize that making mistakes is part of the process of learning, and that continuous learning is what allows an organization to evolve successfully over time. In Chapter 3, we will explore the principles for doing that well. Of course, an idea meritocracy is based on the belief that pulling people's thinking together and stress testing it produces better outcomes than when people keep their disparate thoughts in their own heads. Chapter 4 contains principles for getting in sync well. Knowing how to have thoughtful disagreements is key. Idea meritocracies carefully weigh the merits of its members' opinions. Since many opinions are bad and virtually everyone is confident that theirs are good, the process of being able to sort through them well is important to understand. Chapter 5 explains our system for believability-weighted decision-making. Since disagreements sometimes remain even after decisions are made, one also needs principles for resolving them that are clearly communicated, consistently adhered to, and universally recognized as fair. I go over these in Chapter 6. Make your idea meritocracy work in a way that suits you. While all of what you hear here may seem challenging and complicated in practice, if you believe as I do that there is no better way to make decisions than to have believable people open-mindedly and assertively surface, explore, and resolve their differences, then you will figure out what it takes to operate that way. If an idea meritocracy doesn't work well, the fault doesn't lie in the concept. It lies in people not valuing it enough to make sure that it works. If you take nothing else away from this audiobook, you owe it to yourself to see what it's like to experience an idea meritocracy. If it makes sense to you, I hope you will take the plunge. It won't take long for you to understand what a radical difference it will make to your work and your relationships. To have an idea meritocracy. 1. Put your honest thoughts on the table. 2. Have thoughtful disagreement. 3. Abide by agreed-upon ways of getting past disagreement. Chapter 1. Trust in Radical Truth and Radical Transparency. Understanding what is true is essential for success, and being radically transparent about everything, including mistakes and weaknesses, helps create the understanding that leads to improvements. That's not just a theory. We have put this into practice at Bridgewater for over 40 years, so we know how it works. But like most things in life, being radically truthful and transparent has cons as well as pros, which I will describe as accurately as possible in this chapter. Being radically truthful and transparent with your colleagues and expecting your colleagues to be the same with you ensures that important issues are apparent instead of hidden. It also enforces good behavior and good thinking, because when you have to explain yourself, everyone can openly assess the merits of your logic. If you're handling things well, radical transparency will make that clear, and if you're handling things badly, radical transparency will make that clear as well. So it helps to maintain high standards. Radical truth and radical transparency are fundamental to having a real idea meritocracy. The more people can see what is happening, the good, the bad, and the ugly, the more effective they are at deciding the appropriate ways of handling things. This approach is also invaluable for training. Learning is compounded and accelerated when everyone has the opportunity to hear what everyone else is thinking. As a leader, you will get the feedback essential for your learning and for the continual improvement of the organization's decision-making rules. And seeing firsthand what's happening and why builds trust and allows people to make the independent assessments of the evidence that a functioning idea meritocracy requires. Adapting to radical truth and radical transparency. It takes getting used to. Virtually everyone who joins Bridgewater believes intellectually that radical truth and radical transparency are what they want because, after careful thought, that's what they signed up for. Yet most find it difficult to adjust to it because they struggle with the two U's, as explained in the chapter, Understand That People Are Wired Very Differently. While their upper-level U's understand the benefits of it, their lower-level U's tend to react with a fight-or-flight response. Adapting typically takes about 18 months, though it varies from individual to individual, and there are those who never successfully adapt to it. Some people tell me it's inconsistent with human nature to operate this way, that people need to be protected from harsh truths, and that such a system could never work in practice. Our experience and our success have proven that wrong. While it's true that our way of being is not what most people are used to, that doesn't make it unnatural, any more than the hard physical exercise athletes and soldiers do is unnatural. It is a fundamental law of nature that you get stronger only by doing difficult things. While our idea meritocracy is not for everyone, for those who do adapt to it, which is about two-thirds of those who try it, it is so liberating and effective that it's hard for them to imagine any other way to be. What most people like best is knowing there is no spin. Radical truth and transparency in practice. To give you an idea of what radical truth and transparency look like, I'll share a difficult situation we faced a few years ago when our management committee began thinking about reorganizing our back office. Our back office provides the services we need to support our trading in the markets, including trade confirmations, settlements, record maintenance, and accounting. We had built this team up over many years, and it was full of hard-working, close-knit employees who were part of our extended family. But at the time, we were seeing a need for new capacities that would stretch us beyond what we could do in-house. This led our COO, Eileen Murray, to devise an innovative strategy for spinning off this team and having them incorporated into a tailor-made group within the Bank of New York Mellon. It was just an exploratory conversation at first. We had no idea whether we would pursue it, how we would pursue it, or what that would ultimately mean for the members of our back office team. Put yourself in the shoes of the management committee. When would you tell the back office team that you were thinking of spinning off their group into another company? Would you wait until the picture was clear? In most organizations, this kind of strategic decision would typically be kept under wraps until it was a done deal, because bosses generally think it's bad to create uncertainty among employees. We believe the opposite, that the only responsible way to operate is truthfully and transparently, so that people know what's really going on and can help us sort through any issues that arise. In this case, Eileen led a town hall meeting with the back office team right away. In the way typical of leaders at Bridgewater, she explained that there was a lot she didn't know, and there were a lot of questions that she wouldn't be able to answer. This was the harsh reality at that moment, and while it did create uncertainty, Had she followed the more traditional approach of being less open, the inevitable rumors and speculation would have made things much worse. Though the group ultimately did get spun off, we continue to have wonderful relationships with the people in it. Not only did they cooperate fully throughout the transition, they still come to our Christmas and 4th of July parties and remain a part of our extended family. Today, we have an award-winning back office because of the innovative things this change allowed us to do. Most importantly, since we were operating openly even while we hadn't figured things out, the back office team had their confidence in our truthfulness and consideration for them reinforced, and they returned it in kind. For me, not telling people what's really going on so as to protect them from the worries of life is like letting your kids grow into adulthood believing in the Tooth Fairy or Santa Claus. While concealing the truth might make people happier in the short run, it won't make them smarter or more trusting in the long run. It's a real asset that people know they can trust what we say. For that reason, I believe it's almost always better to shoot straight, even when you don't have all the answers or when there's bad news to convey. As Winston Churchill said, there is no worse course in leadership than to hold out false hopes soon to be swept away. People need to face harsh and uncertain realities if they are going to learn how to deal with them, and you'll learn a lot about the people around you by seeing how well they do. Principle 1.1. Realize that you have nothing to fear from knowing the truth. If you're like most people, the idea of facing the unvarnished truth makes you anxious. To get over that, you need to understand intellectually why untruths are scarier than truths, and then, through practice, get accustomed to living with them. If you're sick, it's natural to fear your doctor's diagnosis. What if it's cancer or some other deadly disease? As scary as the truth may turn out to be, you will be better off knowing it in the long run because it will allow you to seek the most appropriate treatment. The same holds for learning painful truths about your own strengths and weaknesses. Knowing and acting on the truth is what we call the big deal at Bridgewater. It's important not to get hung up on all those emotion and ego-laden little deals that can distract you from the overall mission. Principle 1.2. Have integrity and demand it from others. Integrity comes from the Latin word integritas, meaning one or whole. People who are one way on the inside and another way on the outside, that is, not whole, lack integrity. They have duality instead. While presenting your view as something other than it is can sometimes be easier in the moment because you can avoid conflict or embarrassment or achieve some other short-term goal, the second and third order effects of having integrity and avoiding duality are immense. People who are one way on the inside and another on the outside become conflicted and often lose touch with their own values. It's difficult for them to be happy and almost impossible for them to be their best. Aligning what you say with what you think and what you think with what you feel will make you much happier and much more successful. Thinking solely about what's accurate instead of how it is perceived pushes you to focus on the most important things. It helps you to sort through people and places because you'll be drawn to people and places that are open and honest. It's also fairer to those around you. Making judgments about people so that they are tried and sentenced in your head without asking for their perspective is both unethical and unproductive. Having nothing to hide relieves stress and builds trust. A. Never say anything about someone that you wouldn't say to them directly, and don't try people without accusing them to their face. Criticism is welcomed and encouraged at Bridgewater, but there is never a good reason to badmouth people behind their back. It is counterproductive and shows a serious lack of integrity. It doesn't yield any beneficial change, and it subverts both the person being badmouthed and the environment as a whole. Next to being dishonest, it is the worst thing you can do in our community. Managers should not talk about people who work for them if they are not in the room. If someone is not present at a meeting where something relevant to them is discussed, we always make sure to send them a recording of the meeting and other relevant information. B. Don't let loyalty to people stand in the way of truth and the well-being of the organization. In some companies, employees hide their employers' mistakes, and employers do the same in return. This is unhealthy and stands in the way of improvement because it prevents people from bringing their mistakes and weaknesses to the surface, encourages deception, and eliminates subordinates' right of appeal. The same thing applies to the idea of personal loyalty. I've regularly seen people kept in jobs that they don't deserve because of their personal relationship to the boss, and this leads to unscrupulous managers trading on personal loyalties to build fiefdoms for themselves. Judging one person by a different set of rules than another is an insidious form of corruption that undermines the meritocracy. I believe in a healthier form of loyalty founded on openly exploring what is true. Explicit, principled thinking and radical transparency are the best antidotes for self-dealing. When everyone is held to the same principles and decision-making is done publicly, it is difficult for people to pursue their own interests at the expense of the organization's. In such an environment, those who face their challenges have the most admirable character. When mistakes and weaknesses are hidden, unhealthy character is rewarded instead. Principle 1.3. Create an environment in which everyone has the right to understand what makes sense, and no one has the right to hold a critical opinion without speaking up. Whether people have the independence and character to fight for the best answers will depend upon their nature, but you can encourage them by creating an atmosphere in which everyone's first thought is to ask, "Is it true?" A. Speak up, own it, or get out. In an idea meritocracy, openness is a responsibility. You not only have the privilege to speak up and fight for right, but are obliged to do so. This extends especially to principles. Just like everything else, principles need to be questioned and debated. What you're not allowed to do is complain and criticize privately, either to others or in your own head. If you can't fulfill this obligation, then you must go. Of course, open-mindedly exploring what's true with others is not the same thing as stubbornly insisting that only you are right, even after the decision-making machine has settled an issue and moved on. There will inevitably be cases where you must abide by some policy or decision that you disagree with. B. Be extremely open. Discuss your issues until you are in sync with each other or until you understand each other's positions and can determine what should be done. As someone I worked with once explained, it's simple. Just don't filter. C. Don't be naive about dishonesty. People lie more than most people imagine. I learned that by being in the position of being responsible for everyone in the company. While we have an exceptionally ethical group of people, in all organizations there are dishonest people who have to be dealt with in practical ways. For example, don't believe most people who are caught being dishonest when they say that they've seen the light or will never do it again, because chances are, they will. Dishonest people are dangerous, so keeping them around isn't smart. At the same time, let's be practical. If I tried to limit my relationships to people who never lied, I'd have nobody to work with. While I have extremely high standards when it comes to integrity, I don't view it in a black and white, one strike and you're out way. I look at the severity, the circumstances, and the patterns to try to understand whether I'm dealing with a person who is a habitual liar and will lie to me again, or with a person who is fundamentally honest yet imperfect. I consider the significance of the dishonesty itself. Was the person stealing a piece of cake or were they committing a felony? As well as the nature of our existing relationship. Is it my spouse telling the lie, a casual acquaintance, or an employee? Treating such cases differently is appropriate because a basic law of justice is that the punishment should fit the crime. Principle 1.4. Be radically transparent. If you agree that a real idea meritocracy is an extremely powerful thing, it should not be a great leap for you to see that giving people the right to see things for themselves is better than forcing them to rely on information processed for them by others. Radical transparency forces issues to the surface, most importantly, and most uncomfortably, the problems that people are dealing with and how they're dealing with them, and it allows the organization to draw on the talents and insights of all its members to solve them. Eventually, for people who get used to it, living in a culture of radical transparency is more comfortable than living in the fog of not knowing what's going on and not knowing what people really think. And it is incredibly effective. But to be clear, like most great things, it also has drawbacks. Its biggest drawback is that it is initially very difficult for most people to deal with uncomfortable realities. If unmanaged, it can lead to people getting involved with more things than they should, and can lead people who aren't able to weigh all the information to draw the wrong conclusions. For example, bringing all an organization's problems to the surface and regarding every one of them as intolerable may lead some people to wrongly conclude that their organization has more intolerable problems than another organization that keeps its issues under wraps. Yet which organization is more likely to achieve excellence? One that highlights its problems and considers them intolerable, or one that doesn't? And don't get me wrong, radical transparency isn't the same as total transparency. It just means much more transparency than is typical. We do keep some things confidential, such as private health matters or deeply personal problems, sensitive details about intellectual property or security issues, the timing of a major trade, and at least for the short term, matters that are likely to be distorted, sensationalized, or harmfully misunderstood if leaked to the press. In the following principles, you will get a good explanation of when and why we found it helpful to be transparent, and when and why we found it inappropriate. Frankly, when I started off being so radically transparent, I had no idea how it would go. I just knew that it was extremely important and that I had to fight hard and find ways to make it happen. I pushed the limits and was surprised by how well it worked. For example, when I started taping all our meetings, our lawyers told us we were crazy because we were creating evidence that could be used against us in court or by regulators such as the SEC. In response, I theorized that radical transparency would reduce the risk of our doing anything wrong and of not dealing appropriately with our mistakes, and that the tapes would in fact protect us. If we were handling things well, our transparency would make that clear, provided, of course, that all parties are reasonable, which isn't something you can always take for granted. And if we were handling things badly, our transparency would ensure that we would get what we deserve, which, in the long run, would be good for us. I didn't know for sure at the time, but our experience has proven this theory correct time and again. Bridgewater has had uncommonly few legal or regulatory encounters, largely because of our radical transparency. That's because it's tougher to do bad things and easier to find out what's true and resolve claims through radical transparency. Over the last several decades, we have not had a single material legal or regulatory judgment against us. Naturally, growing bigger and more successful attracts more media attention, and reporters know that salacious and controversial stories draw more eyeballs than balanced ones. Bridgewater is especially vulnerable to this kind of reporting because with our culture of bringing problems to the surface and sharing them transparently within the company, we leave ourselves open to leaks. Would it be better not to be transparent and so avoid such problems? I've learned that the people whose opinions matter most are those who know us best, our clients and our employees, and that our radical transparency serves us well within them. Not only has it led to our producing better results, but it also builds trust with our employees and clients so that mischaracterizations in the press roll off their backs. When we discuss such situations with them, they say that for us not to operate transparently would scare them much more. Having the sort of understanding and support to do the right things has been immeasurably valuable. But we wouldn't have known about these great payoffs if we hadn't so steadfastly pushed the limits of this truth and transparency. A. Use transparency to help enforce justice. When everyone can follow the discussion leading up to a decision, either in real time in person or via taped records and email threads, justice is more likely to prevail. Everyone is held accountable for their thinking, and anyone can weigh in on who should do what according to shared principles. Absent such a transparent process, decisions would be settled behind closed doors by those who have the power to do whatever they want. With transparency, everyone is held to the same high standards. B. Share the things that are hardest to share. While it might be tempting to limit transparency to the things that can't hurt you, it is especially important to share the things that are most difficult to share, because if you don't share them, you will lose the trust and partnership of the people you are not sharing with. So, when faced with the decision to share the hardest things, the question should not be whether to share, but how. We will go over principles that will help you do this well. C. Keep exceptions to radical transparency very rare. While I would like virtually total transparency and wish that everyone would handle the information they have access to responsibly to work out what's true and what to do about it, I realize that's an ideal to be approached but never fully achieved. There are exceptions to every rule, and in very rare cases, it is better not to be radically transparent. In those unusual cases, you will need to figure out a way that preserves the culture of radical transparency without exposing you and those you care about to undue risks. When weighing an exception, approach it as an expected value calculation, taking into consideration the second and third order consequences. Ask yourself whether the costs of making the case transparent and managing the risks of that transparency outweigh the benefits. In the vast majority of cases, they don't. I've found that the most common reasons to limit broad transparency are 1. Where the information is of a private, personal, or confidential nature and doesn't meaningfully impact the community at large. 2. Where sharing and managing such information puts the long-term interests of the Bridgewater community, its clients, and our ability to uphold our principles at risk. For instance, our proprietary investment logic or a legal dispute. 3. Where the value of sharing the information broadly with the community is very low, and the distraction it would cause would be significant. Compensation, for instance. What I'm saying is that I believe one should push the limits of being transparent while remaining prudent. Because we tape virtually everything, including our mistakes and weaknesses, for everyone to see, we are a target-rich environment for media that thrives on sensationalistic or critical gossip and can find ways of having information leaked to them. In one case, when we faced the problem of having information leaked to the press that was intentionally distorted and hurt our recruiting efforts, we were forced to institute some controls on ultra-sensitive information so that only a significant number of ultra-trustworthy people received it in real time, and it was distributed to others after a delay. The information was the sort that in a typical company would be shared with just a handful, but at Bridgewater was shared with nearly 100 trusted people. In other words, while our radical transparency in that case wasn't total, I pushed its limits in a practical way. It served us well, because the people who most needed the transparency got it right away, and most everyone understood that the commitment to being transparent remained very much intact, even in challenging circumstances. People know that my intent is to always push the limits of trying to be transparent, and that the only things that would prevent me from doing that will be the interests of the company, and that I will tell them if I can't be transparent and why. It is in our culture to be that way, and that fosters trust, even when the transparency is less than we would like it to be. D. Make sure those who are given radical transparency recognize their responsibilities to handle it well and to weigh things intelligently. People cannot be given the privilege of receiving information and then use the information to harm the company, so rules and procedures must be in place to ensure that doesn't happen. For example, we provide great transparency inside Bridgewater on the condition that Bridgewater citizens do not leak it outside. If they do, they will be dismissed for cause for unethical behavior. Additionally, the rules for how issues are explored and decisions are made must be maintained, and because different people have different perspectives, it's important that the paths for resolving them are followed. For example, some people are going to make big deals out of little deals, come up with their own wrong theories, or have problems seeing how things are evolving. Remind them of the risks that the company takes to give them that transparency and their responsibilities to handle the information that they get responsibly. I have found that people appreciating this transparency and knowing that they will lose it if it is not handled well leads them to enforce good behavior with each other. E. Provide transparency to people who handle it well and either deny it to people who don't handle it well or remove those people from the organization. It is the right and responsibility of management and not the right of all employees to determine when exceptions to radical transparency should be made. Management should restrict transparency sparingly and wisely, because every time they do, it undermines the idea meritocracy and people's trust. F. Don't share sensitive information with the organization's enemies. Both inside and outside of any organization, there are some people who will intentionally cause the organization harm. If these enemies are within your organization, you need to call them out to resolve this conflict through the organization's system for achieving such resolutions, because working with enemies within your extended family will undermine you and the family. If the enemies are outside your organization and will use the information to harm you, of course, don't share it. Principle 1.5. Meaningful relationships and meaningful work are mutually reinforcing, especially when supported by radical truth and radical transparency. The most meaningful relationships are achieved when you and others can speak openly to each other about everything that's important, learn together, and understand the need to hold each other accountable to be as excellent as they can be. When you have such relationships with those you work with, you pull each other through challenging times. At the same time, sharing challenging work draws you closer and strengthens your relationships. This self-reinforcing cycle creates the success that allows you to pursue more and more ambitious goals. Chapter 2. Cultivate meaningful work and meaningful relationships. Meaningful relationships are invaluable for building and sustaining a culture of excellence, because they create the trust and support that people need to push each other to do great things. If the overwhelming majority of people care about having an excellent community, they will take care of it, which will yield both better work and better relationships. Relationships have to be genuine, not forced. At the same time, the culture of the community will have a big influence on how people value relationships and how they behave with each other. To me, a meaningful relationship is one in which people care enough about each other to be there whenever someone needs support, and they enjoy each other's company so much that they can have great times together both inside and outside of work. I literally love many of the people I work with, and I respect them deeply. I've often been asked whether relationships at Bridgewater are more like those of a family or those of a team, the implication being that in a family there is unconditional love and a permanent relationship, while in a team the attachment is only as strong as the person's contribution. Before answering this question, I want to emphasize that either is good by me, because both families and teams provide meaningful relationships, and that neither is anything like a typical job at a typical company where the relationships are primarily utilitarian. But, to answer the question directly, I wanted Bridgewater to be like a family business in which family members have to perform excellently or be cut. If I had a family business and a family member wasn't performing well, I would want to let them go, because I believe that isn't good for either the family member, because staying in a job they're not suited to stands in the way of their personal evolution, or the company, because it holds back the whole community. That's tough love. To give you an idea of how Bridgewater's culture developed and how it's different from what you'd find at most companies, I will tell you about how we handled benefits in our early days. When the company was just me and a small group of people, I didn't provide employees with health insurance. I assumed that they would buy it on their own. But I did want to help the people I shared my life with during their times of need. If someone I worked with got seriously sick and couldn't afford proper care, what was I going to do? Stand by and not help them? Of course, I'd help them financially to whatever extent I could. So when I did begin providing health insurance to my employees, I felt that I was insuring myself against the money I knew I'd give them if they were injured or fell ill, as much as I was insuring them. Because I wanted to make certain that they received the best care possible, the policies I provided allowed them to go to any doctor they chose and spend whatever amount was required. On the other hand, I didn't protect them against the little things. For example, I didn't provide dental insurance any more than I provided car insurance, because I felt that it was their own responsibility to protect their teeth, just as it was their own responsibility to take care of their car. If they needed dental insurance, they could pay for it out of their own pocket. My main point is that I didn't approach benefits in the impersonal, transactional way most companies do, but more like something I provided for my family. I was more than generous with some things and expected people to take personal responsibility for others. When I treated my employees like extended family, I found that they typically behave the same way with each other and our community as a whole, which was much more special than having a strictly quid pro quo relationship. I can't tell you how many people would do anything in their power to help our community and company and wouldn't want to work anywhere else. This is invaluable. As Bridgewater grew, my ability to have quality personal contact with everyone faded. But this wasn't a problem because the broader community embraced this way of being with each other. This didn't just happen. We did a lot to help it along. For example, we put into place a policy that we would pay for half of practically any activities that people want to do together up to a set cap. We now support more than 100 clubs and athletic and common interest groups. We paid for food and drink for those who hosted potluck dinners at their house, and we bought a house that employees can use for events and celebrations. We have Christmas, Halloween, 4th of July, and other parties that often include family members. Eventually, others who valued this kind of relationship took responsibility for it, and it spread to become a cultural norm so that I could just sit back and watch beauty happen. What about the person who doesn't give a damn about all this meaningful relationship stuff, who just wants to go into work, do a good job, and receive fair compensation? Is that okay? Well, sure it is, and it's common for a significant percentage of employees. Not everyone feels the same or is expected to feel the same about the community. It's totally okay to opt out. We have all sorts of people and respect whatever they want to do on their own time, as long as they abide by the law and are considerate. But these are not the folks who will provide the community with the skeletal strength of commitment that is essential for it to be extraordinary over very long periods of time. No matter how much one tries to create a culture of meaningful relationships, the organization is bound to have some bad, intentionally harmful people in it. Being there isn't good for them or the company, so it's best to find out who they are and remove them. We have found that the higher the percentage of people who really care about the organization, the fewer the number of bad people there are, because the people who really care protect the community against them. We have also found that our radical transparency helps make it clearer which are which. Principle 2.1. Be loyal to the common mission and not to anyone who is not operating consistently with it. Loyalty to specific people who are not in tight sync with the mission and how to achieve it will create factionalism and undermine the well-being of the community. It is often the case, and quite beautiful, that personal loyalties exist. However, it is also often the case, and quite ugly, when personal loyalties come into conflict with the organization's interests. Principle 2.2. Be crystal clear on what the deal is. To have a good relationship, you must be clear with each other about what the quid pro quo is, what is generous, what is fair, and what is just plain taking advantage, and how you will be with each other. One important thing that typically divides people is how they approach their work. Are they working just for their paycheck, or are they looking for something more? Each of us has our own views about what is most important. I've made a lot of money through my work, but I see my job as much more than a way to make money. It's how I choose to live out my values around excellence, meaningful work, and meaningful relationships. If the people I worked with were primarily interested in making money, we would have conflicts whenever we had to choose between upholding our values and making an easy buck. And don't get me wrong, of course I understand that people don't work for personal satisfaction alone, and that a job must be economically viable. But we all have definite ideas about what we value and what we want our relationships to be like, and employers and employees have to be in sync on such things. Naturally, there will be disagreement and negotiation, but some things cannot be compromised, and you and your employees must know what those things are. This is especially true if you're seeking to create an environment that has shared values, a deep commitment to the mission, and high standards of behavior. At Bridgewater, we expect people to behave in a manner that is consistent with how people in high-quality, long-term relationships behave, that is, with a high level of mutual consideration for each other's interests, and a clear understanding of who is responsible for what. On the surface, that sounds nice and straightforward, but what exactly does that mean? It is important to be clear. Take, for example, a case in which an employee's family member is diagnosed with a severe illness, or an employee dies tragically, leaving his or her family in a precarious situation. These things happen far more often than any of us would like them to, and there are, of course, customs and laws that define the basic accommodations and benefits, such as personal vacation days, short and long-term disability insurance, and life insurance, that are required. But how do you determine what kinds of assistance should be provided beyond that? What are the principles for deciding how to handle each specific situation fairly, which may not always mean doing the same thing in every case? None of this is easy, but the upcoming principles will provide some guidance. A. Make sure people give more consideration to others than they demand for themselves. This is a requirement. Being considerate means allowing other people to mostly do what they want so long as it is consistent with our principles, policies, and the law. It also means being willing to put others ahead of your own desires. If the people on both sides of an argument approach their disagreements in this way, we will have many fewer disputes about who is offending whom. Still, judgments will have to be made and lines will have to be drawn and set down in policies. This is the overarching guideline. It is more inconsiderate to prevent people from exercising their rights because you are offended by them than it is for them to do whatever it is that offends you. That said, it is inconsiderate not to weigh the impact of one's actions on others, so we expect people to use sensible judgment in not doing obviously offensive things. There are some behaviors that are clearly offensive to many people, and it is appropriate to specify and prohibit them in clear policies. The list of those specifics and the policies pertaining to them arise from specific cases. Applying this principle to them is done in much the same way that case law is created. B. Make sure that people understand the difference between fairness and generosity. Sometimes people mistake generosity for not being fair. For example, when Bridgewater arranged for a bus to shuttle people who live in New York City to our Connecticut office, one employee asked, "It seems it would be fair to also compensate those of us who spend hundreds of dollars on gas each month, particularly in light of the New York City bus." This line of thinking mistakes an act of generosity for some for an entitlement for everyone. Fairness and generosity are different things. If you bought two birthday gifts for two of your closest friends and one cost more than the other, what would you say if the friend who got the cheaper gift accused you of being unfair? Probably something like, "I didn't have to get you any gift, so stop complaining." At Bridgewater, we are generous with people, and I am personally generous. But we feel no obligation to be measured and equal in our generosity. Generosity is good and entitlement is bad, and they can easily be confused, so be crystal clear on which is which. Decisions should be based on what you believe is warranted in a particular circumstance and what will be most appreciated. If you want to have a community of people who have both high-quality long-term relationships and a high sense of personal responsibility, you can't allow a sense of entitlement to creep in. C. Know where the line is and be on the far side of fair. The line is what's fair, appropriate, or required as distinct from what's generous, in light of the defined quid pro quo relationship between parties. As mentioned earlier, you should expect people to behave in a manner consistent with how people in high-quality long-term relationships behave, with a high level of mutual consideration for each other's interests and a clear understanding of who is responsible for what. Each should operate on the far side of fair, by which I mean giving more consideration to others than you demand for yourself. This is different from how people in most commercial relationships generally behave, as they tend to focus more on their own interests than on the interests of others or of the community as a whole. If each party says, "You deserve more," no, "you deserve more," rather than "I deserve more," you are more likely to have generous, good relationships. D. Pay for work. While it isn't all about the quid pro quo between the company and the employee, this balance must be economically viable for the relationships to be sustainable. Set policies that clearly define this quid pro quo and be measured but not excessively precise when shifting it around. While you should by and large stick to the arrangement, you should also recognize that there are rare special times when employees will need a bit of extra time off, and there are times that the company will require employees to give it extra hours. The company should pay for above normal work one way or another, and employees should be docked for below normal work. The give and take should roughly equal out over time. Within reasonable boundaries, no